You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. I think you're going to love this conversation today. It is with the Right Reverend Marianne Edgar Buddy, who is the Bishop and Spiritual Leader of the Episcopal Diocese of Washington, D.C. and the Washington National Cathedral. Prior to her election in 2011, she was parish priest in Minneapolis for 18 years. She is the author of the book, How We Learn to Be Brave. And today, we're talking to her about her new book. It's a young reader's edition of that book, adapted by Brian Bliss. It's titled, We Can Be Brave, How We Learn to Be Brave in Life's Decisive Moments. Enjoy the pod. Marianne, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
In the preface to your new book, you write, quote, "It has never been my intention or desire to be best known for words spoken to or about President Donald J. Trump," end quote. And yet, here we are.
Here we are.
So let's acknowledge that moment, because I think how most people know you, and I was telling people I was going to interview you, is for this these words you spoke to the president. So can you just sort of recapture what that moment was all about?
Yes. In January of this year, the day after the presidential inauguration, as is the custom of Washington National Cathedral, we hosted a prayer service for the nation, and the president was in attendance with his family and members of his support, his inaugural committee and others. I spoke about unity, the need, the foundational pillars of unity, and at the end of that address, I spoke to him directly about the final pillar, which is the need in a free society that focuses on justice and to have mercy. And I chose the word mercy carefully as a way to acknowledge, number one, that he had just been elected to the most powerful position in the world, and he felt that God had protected him, spared his life to carry out his destiny. And I hoped that he had it in him to have a bit of generosity of spirit for those who were terrified of the things that had been said about them from his mouth and others during the campaign. So that's the piece that it seems has touched a nerve or resonated most powerfully.
It didn't seem to sink in.
No, I wasn't expecting an about face, as you can imagine. I wasn't expecting any of that. But I also felt, to be honest, Kelly, I felt like I had an opportunity to bring the full humanity of people who had been so terribly dehumanized in the context of public speech. And that is a terrifying experience when your very being is being discussed by powerful people as if you are less than human or less than deserving of basic decency, and not to mention protection of your human and civil rights. And so I was speaking for a wider audience than simply the president, but I didn't want to make any mistake to him or to anyone else that I felt he was in a position not only to do some of the things that he had every right to do given the election, but to do so with a modicum of compassion and a softening of rhetoric, which, as you said, has not happened.
It's interesting. You write, quote, "Our scriptures are quite clear that God is never impressed with prayers when actions are not informed by them," end quote. And this feels like, well, in many ways, it's the most common thing, right? I mean, Bob Dylan has been quoted by saying this, as well as our founding fathers, in terms of hiding behind sort of patriotism and people hiding behind scripture, but also not following those. Because doing the right thing is often, if not always, the harder thing. And so we actually just had on the podcast Runjay Galati, who's a Harvard professor who has a book called How to Be Bold, and it's the science of courage. And one of the things that dovetails with what you write about, that he writes about, is it's not that bravery is the absence of fear. It's standing up in the face of fear. Right. And this wasn't an easy moment for you. Like, you didn't want to necessarily take that on. And we all have those lives, right, where we do that. But you make a small step.
Right.
See what happens.
Right. And also, it was an opportunity to remind us all of some pretty basic principles that are necessary if we're going to live as diverse people in a free society, right? And upon which our democracy depends. Now, it happens that there are also spiritual values. So I felt I was in my lane. He was in our church, right? But it is also a reminder, as you said, that if we're going to pray for these things, we also have to work for them. We have to show up in the places where our essence is present and accounted for. And that, by the way, and that's happening across the country. It's not necessarily happening among our political class, but it is most certainly happening across the country. And I'm thrilled to be a small part of that.
Yeah, yeah. So this book is for young readers, right? And what I found fascinating about that is you have a quote where you say, quote, "Parenting was for me a masterclass in courage, not a class that I taught, but one where I was the student," end quote. I relate to that 1,000%.
I have yet to meet a parent who doesn't, right?
Yeah,
think of it. We watch our kids from the time they are the smallest of infants every day doing something that they've never done before. And also facing into things that for them in their world are just enormous, and in fact are enormous for us to watch. And we watch them and we support as best we can, but they are their own beings going off into the horizons that are set before them. And it's awe-inspiring. One of the reasons I wanted to write the book was to underscore for young people that they know a lot about this already. Right. This isn't something that, I wanted to remind them. I wanted to surround them with examples and all sorts of things. But they know this because it is the terrain of growing up as a human being.
I was having lunch yesterday with an old friend who the last time I saw him was at the memorial service for our daughter, Nora, who died of cancer.
Yes.
And it was... He talked about the odd joy he felt leaving that service because, there's so many people who are speaking about their love for her. He felt he like knew her and he never met her.
Right.
And you talk in the book about you lost your brother-in-law to cancer. You suffer from chronic pain. I have some of that. And I think this is a thing we don't talk about enough because it is common to most people to go through these tragedies. And when we don't talk about them, we're not allowing ourselves to learn from each other. And that's been the case for me, which is like, I love to talk about Nora because it's a way of me invoking her spirit in the world.
Right.
And, and I think, in the job you have, you hear about this stuff a lot, right?
I do. And I'm privileged to walk with people through some of those darkest times. And let me just say, I'm really sorry that you lost your daughter. She seemed like an amazing person, and the light and life of her is something you will always cherish. And it is right to bring her, to evoke her spirit and her presence into the world. I also, it's hard to talk about what we learn through suffering. Right. Because who wants to suffer? None of us want to suffer. And if we could spare one another the suffering that we endure, we'd do it. We'd walk over hot coals to spare our loved ones what they must go through. And so it takes a certain amount of care and timing, I think, to touch that tender space. But once you're in the suffering club and you name it, there's like it's almost like a secret handshake. It's like, oh, you understand. you understand. And then you can also understand how people still get up in the morning and go about their lives, even though they're carrying whatever it is they're carrying, right? And the heroism of that, the cost of it and the sense of responsibility for it, the days you can't do it, and so somebody carries it for you. I mean, all of those things. And to acknowledge that as the terrain of our humanity that we will never fully avoid. And while we would never choose it, it does have priceless lessons to teach us, and it makes us more of who we are.
Yeah, we drew so much on our world of improvisation. There's a phrase we use, you need to play the scene you're in, not the scene you want to be in. Right? And you can see why a young comedian would need that in terms of they're getting thrown stuff. It's like, oh, wait a second.
That's not the line I was expecting, right?
Yeah. It's a life lesson. It requires you to be fully, fiercely present in the moment.
Right.
And that journey, when we were there, that was great. I mean, that was the, it's like, oh, we should always live like that. By the way, it's exhausting.
We can't live like that all the way. But it is good to know when you're in it, that's where you belong. You totally belong there. And it calls forth from us, in my experience, I should say, it calls forth from us qualities and attributes we didn't know we have, and also that are not available to us all the time, right? Because I don't know about you, but I can't live like that all the time. I don't have that all the time. And as a spiritual leader, I would say it's given to us for certain seasons. And then on some level, we recognize that, okay, this little human vessel is done for a while, and I'll come back to this later. Right?
So for just a point in our world, improv rehearsals never longer than 3 hours.
Okay.
I mean, literally, we just know you're running out of juice. You got to go rest. You do something, and then you come back. You know, and you might be able to do the thing in the evening. That's fine, but that's very much that world. Very early in this podcast, I got introduced to the Reverend Dr. Sam Wells.
Do you know Sam? I do.
Of course.
You know Sam Wells.
Yes.
Wonderful man.
And he, you know, he had studied improvisation. He was finding the connection between that and his world. And so we had this really gorgeous conversation about those worlds. And we do a lot of work in the ethics and compliance area. And I'm like, oh, this makes perfect sense now how all this ties together. Because in improvisation, my job is to take care of you. Your job is to take care of me. That's a simple agreement we have before we do anything. And then there are other agreements and practices and rights. One right that we have before we go on stage, before any workshop or any show, is we pat each other on the back and say, I got your back.
I love that.
Yeah. It's small, but that's important.
It is not small. Mm-hmm. And it allows an expansiveness of courage that would otherwise not be present. So that's beautiful. Thank you for sharing it with me.
Yeah. Okay, so you and I also believe stories are everything. They're the best. And you talk in the book that you were a junior in high school when basically your family fell apart.
Right.
What happened?
It was, I've had several families. This was my dad and my stepmom. I was living with them and my younger half-brother, 9 years my junior. My sister had long since left the house, my older sister. And my dad, who was in a state of lots of things, including some alcohol abuse and depression, announced to me that he was leaving my stepmother and wanted me to come with him. And I knew that was just not a possibility for me. I also couldn't stay with my stepmother because she really didn't like me very much. Mm-hmm. And in the kind of dynamic of our family, my dad had sort of taken me on as, you know, his de facto ally in some pretty awful marital dynamics. And she had latched on, understandably, to her son, fiercely protecting him. And so it was just a real, it was a real cauldron of emotion. And at the same time, I was finding myself and my identity and my community in my school and in my circle of friends who happened to be a group of Christians. And I had found a church, and I was in the play, and I didn't want to leave. But I knew that I had to leave. I knew that I couldn't stay where I was. And it was a kind of a clarion, a moment of clarity that I had never experienced before, in part because it was over against a lot of what the well-wishing adults and authority figures in my life wanted. And the leaving meant going back to live with my mom, my birth mom, whom I had pretty much scorned when I was younger in a fierce, nasty custody battle with my dad. And so it was a reckoning of sorts. It was an acknowledging of her presence in my life, which had never, she had never wavered, even though I treated her horribly for years. And it was a sense that, you know, I needed to go where I was, where someone wanted me, right? Mm. And even though I didn't want to go, I mean, I would have given anything on some level to stay where I was. And yet it was so clear, Kelly, and it was so internally driven that I, there was also a kind of exhilaration about it. Oh my God, this is happening. I am trusting for the first time that I can remember an inner directive that is asking me to do, up until that point, the most terrifying thing I'd ever done, and to say goodbye to people that I loved. So it was, for me, it's the moment I come back to even now. I'm 66. I come back to it as sort of the defining moment of what it feels like inside when you are stepping across the threshold of courage. How you say, it doesn't really matter how you feel in that moment. It's not, it matters, but it's not the most important data point. The most important is that you respond with whatever you feel courage is asking you to do.
And this chapter is called Deciding to Go. I think it's the first chapter because it's in many ways the hardest thing to do. I think about in the context of my various quittings. We talked to Annie Duke on the podcast. Her last book is all about how quitting gets a bad name. There's so many things that's like sunk cost fallacy. Everyone quit, like move on. And for me, it's like, yeah, I quit a sport that I was physically getting hurt and psychologically getting hurt. And I'm turning 60. I was not going to be a professional soccer player at that time. If it were today, I probably could have been and made some money. Not that. Quit a marriage that didn't work. I've been married to the love of my life for decades now, and it's like and that was a smart quit. But those things, that it's not that they don't come with cost, but they do come with cost. They also come with incredible rich opportunity,
right,
that wouldn't have been there otherwise.
Right.
And
right.
Then you sideways into deciding to stay, which is also potentially an unpopular idea because that comes with a cost too. So you had that moment for yourself too, where it's like, okay, I'm weighing all the things, and when I decide to stay, and for me, that's, you know, this is now 38 years at Second City.
Yeah.
Like, I decided to stay, and I roughed it out through some real bad stuff.
Yes. Yes. No, that's the commonality, which is the crisis moments where we actually come to a decision. And even what you're describing, and certainly in my experience, there's a big part of me, of us, that wants nothing more than to get out of here, to get out, to leave. And yet, again, the call, the sense of the scene that you're in, to use that great phrase from improv, is actually where you belong. And then the learning, and I think this is important, it's not to stay the same. It's not to stay and do nothing. It's a call to stay and go deeper, or to become a new version of who you are in this place. Or maybe that's not quite the right way of saying it, but you know what I mean. One of my favorite example is Eleanor Roosevelt and her decision to stay married to FDR after he had an affair with her personal secretary. And she decided to stay married, but their marriage was not the same after that. I mean, she became her own person. And so I feel like it's a growth moment, and it also provides stability and opportunity for other people in your world to be able to count on you. And so I feel like it's one of the costs that we measure as we grow older. I mean, it happens in young life as well, but particularly as we get older, we realize more and more people are kind of counting on us to be the foundation upon which they will thrive or they will launch, right? And I'm not saying that's the only thing to take into account, but it is an important one, right? That, yeah. And so I love, I actually really love the interchange between those mm-hmm. two goals. And a few people have criticized me, and I think it's a fair criticism. I'm not telling people that you should stay or go, right? That's for you to decide, right? But there are some things to really ponder, and there will be costs, and as you said, perhaps untold riches, should you decide one way or the other, right?
And I'm a big fan of the in-betweens, but there's a point where you can't do that with these.
Well,
you can't. Like, you're either in the band or you're out of the band.
I mean, and we try, and we there are those mm-hmm. moments, there are those seasons when we're kind of in between, but they're borrowed seasons, right?
You can't, yeah, totally.
You can't stay there for long with any real integrity, or you diminish both yourself and whatever
yes.
it is, you know, whatever relationships or endeavors you're a part of. So, yeah.
I had such an emotional roller coaster with this book. Just so you know, it's a good thing, because the next chapter, which is called Deciding to Start, I'm like, oh my god. So I had basically decided I was never going to write the follow up to the Yes And book, because when Nora was sick, I kept a caring bridge. I wrote my book and it was done, and it was that in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And then the team that brought us together. Jojo at Original Strategies was the one who called me and says, tell me why you're not writing the follow-up. And I told her the whole story, and she's like, okay, I completely understand that. Also, you don't have to do it alone. And it never dawned on me that I could just start, but with an ensemble, with help, with that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And so I'm working on this now with my wife Anne, with our friend Dave, who's a behavioral scientist. And The first chapter is based on work that we've been doing that we did at the FBI with hostage crisis negotiators, where we were teaching them improvisational exercises to help them in these moments. And that title of the very first chapter of this new book that I'm working on is called Just Start.
Just Start.
There's no context you can understand to have the right words. You can't read minds. You can't. So you just start and you make the discovery inch by inch by inch. And again, yeah. this is an improv thing, but it's also a life thing. And you talk about that, you know, you say, quote, in the book, the call to start is almost always initially private, which I think
yeah.
is true, because it's that little thing speaking to you, but then it quickly becomes unprivate.
Right. Right. Although in my experience, and again, not in hostage situations, which is like,
yeah, the stakes are pretty high.
I'm still thinking about that. But the idea that I'm deciding something, I'm deciding to start something, which actually may look like on the outside that I'm taking a couple steps back, right? Or that I'm not doing anything at all because I'm getting ready, or I need more tools in my toolkit, or I have to prepare in some way. Then you start taking steps toward this thing. But it's long enough, far enough out. These are the kinds of starting that I was describing. It's far enough out that the people around you can forget that that's where you're going, right?
Yeah.
Because you are just going about life, but you've got this goal that you're moving toward all the time. Or to use your example, in sort of immediacy, there are things that you learn having taken four or five steps that you would never know if you never took the first.
That's right.
And it's never a sure bet either. I mean, none of these things are guarantees. And I'll tell you, I don't think it's made it into the book. Maybe it did. But our younger son, who's the theater major from Northwestern, mm-hmm. as most theater majors are, parents of theater majors, I should say, often get the look from other adults when their child announces that they're going to be a theater major. And that happened on more than one occasion. Like, I would just get this look like, you're sending your kids to Northwestern to be a theater major. Mm-hmm. And so one time, one of my dear friends asked our son, well, Patrick, you know, what's your plan B? And he said, well, I don't really think of it that way. I'll walk this path as long as I can. And if I need to change, that will be my next plan A. And I love that because
it
is it's like, yeah, I mean, this is the path I'm on. And if I don't walk this, I'll never know. And so, and like you said, you know, you don't have to do it alone. There are a lot of things that happen along the way. But I think one of the things that is, for me, a marker is there's an end goal that for a brief moment, you were given eyes to see, and you want to get there. You want to get there. And it's going to take a long time. But staying where you are isn't an option if you want to get there. Right? And there might change, but you're still moving toward that horizon.
And let me just suggest that in the world of AI, a theater major is maybe very well suited to navigate the world they're in. This is coming from son number six, who said to his dad, I want to be a playwright. And my dad said, finally. He was thrilled. And he got me the informational interview that got me the job at Second City.
Wow.
Where I met my wife, Anne, who is Stephen Colbert's roommate at Northwestern, where they were studying theater.
There you go.
And our 28-year-old son, Nick, is at the Atlanta Shakespeare Theater, where he is an associate there. And I mean, he's also writing and he directs and he bartends. And, you know, you don't know where this thing is going to take you. But if you don't give a shot to the thing that you think is the passion, the purpose, and the love, it is going to be regret city for the rest of your life. And I know this because I know the 50 and 60-year-olds who take classes at Second City going like, I should have done this earlier. And they're doing it now and they're having fun, but they should have done it earlier.
Yeah, I also think, that's a really powerful story. I was going to say that I think that there is something to be said for being willing to risk failure for the things that matter most, and being willing to risk disappointment, that's part of it, right? Not everything is going to work out, and not everything is going to, but that you realize sort of there's a, and I'll tell you, I had my college roommate was also big into theater, and I watched her, and I was dabbling in it and had some fantasies about it. But then I watched her and I realized, you know what? She really loves it even when it flops. She right. really loves it even when nothing happens. And I don't love it when it's. So I think I'm going to go find something that I love that I would stick with even if I failed at it, you know? And I think that that's part of the self-discovery, that a life of courage and an understanding of courage, that it's not just these, you know, Olympic moments when you cross the finish line, or it's just for the brave people, but it's really the way God has created us to walk through this world, crossing thresholds of unknown, that make us who we are.
I should also note that your job is orating in front of audiences. So I don't know
It training has held me in good stead. Although I'm thinking it's time for me to take an improv class.
At worst, it's like 3 hours off your phone and looking at people in the eye, which is a pretty big deal these days.
Yeah, it's pretty intense.
Speaking of that, one of my favorite Second City moments of all time. This is maybe 15 years ago. We were at a very posh event in Washington, D.C., and we had been prepped ahead of time that this very esteemed individual would be happy to improvise with us if we brought her up from the audience. And that was Madeleine Albright. We asked if anyone wanted to improvise. Hand went up. The brooch was glimmering off the stage lights.
Oh, yeah.
And she was brilliant. She just did basically the whole thing with improv is like, we're going to give you this very specific instruction. If you just do that, you will succeed.
Right.
And it's so many people are like, well, that can't be all it is. Like, trust us, that's all it is. And this woman knew how to take the note, man. And she was great. And, you got to officiate.
I did. I officiated at her service and actually offer a homily, which meant I really had to study her life.
Yeah.
And read all
what
of her.
A story.
And so, so powerful. And she's also a brilliant, brilliant writer. But I loved the way her young adult life informed everything about her, because she, you know, she spent most of her 20s and 30s being basically a really good DC mom, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, she just was in the sort of affluent circles where you're doing all the meetings and the PTA and making things happen at your kid's school. And meanwhile, she's studying Russian and getting a PhD in this and that and just kind of preparing herself for something. But at the same time, just watching how people interact with each other, right? And, you know, and she said that's where she got her political training, was just watching people and function, you know, learning how to make things, how to create safety and make space for people, and to deal with bullies and yeah. how to win them over or neutralize them, one or the other. Loved.
You quote, actually say she writes in one of her memoirs. So just right there. Come on. But you write that she says, quote, "The goal we see and the good we hope for comes not as a final reward, but as the hidden companion to our quest. It is not what we find, but the reason we cannot stop looking and striving that tells us why we are here."
Yeah.
If that is not a clarion call for what we call process, that just like this is a process. It's all a process. And by the way, we are not doing it alone.
That's right. Yeah. And we don't necessarily know fully the part we're playing in this larger scene, this larger life.
No, because the script is being written moment by moment.
And it preceded us and it will follow us. And we're on for, you know, I'm going to beat this metaphor to death, but you know what I'm saying in terms of the moment that we're given. Yeah. And the journey. And I think that's what she, you know, it said like, even if the outcome eludes you, the meaning is in the path we walk.
In a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story. But before we do that, towards the end of the book, you talk about a mentor, Rabbi Edwin Friedman.
Yeah.
Wow. And he taught you about leadership. And you note that he said, quote, "The safest place for ships is the harbor, but that's not what ships are for."
Mm-hmm.
That you could have just written that and handed it in, and I've been like, yes. "Good, A plus."
Yeah, no. I mean, he was like that all the time. You know, you just the spirit of adventure, and how he would often say that it is the spirit of adventure. I think Jane Goodall would call it our innate hope. You know, there's just a word. People have different words for that part of humanity that propels us, and he was very clear that there is that gulp factor of life, but if you want to be safe, you are abdicating the very existence that you were given. So
the term safe spaces, you know. Mm-hmm. I want to create safe spaces in the world. Second City in particular is a safe space to risk.
That's it.
So that's really what it is, which is like, no, we have these walls. We have these agreements. We got you. I got you. But we're going to try to do something bigger than any one of us by doing this together. And that requires risk and failure and all those things. And, oh, by the way, we're doing it without a script in front of a paying an audience member that paid way too much money to see this thing. So, but then you realize then they know what you're doing. They're complicit in this. Yeah. And the thing we sort of teach is like most of these audiences, 99% of the audiences, not just a Second City, I think across in your church, in boardrooms, sort of, they want you to succeed.
Yeah.
So it's like, no, we got all we need. We can do this. And is it always going to work out? Absolutely not. But when it does, man, there's no better feeling.
Right. I think a lot about that concept of safety as well. And like you, I mean, part of my job is to create safe spaces. I also know that once a person or an institution has internalized a deeper safety, what feels like being unsafe is actually an expression of a different kind of safety. Right? Mm. And so I feel like one of our responsibilities as human beings is to up our threshold for risk. Yeah. But that's not by being foolish or being, you know, It's not like a death wish. It's just saying, hey, there are some things in life that I am willing to risk, even a certain amount of safety, because the outcome or the promise of it is worth it. Now, I will create different thresholds for people that I love, and I would never impose, you know, I'm not going to force this on anyone, but there is something to life that says part of our job, part of our calling as human beings is to be large enough inside, to grow large enough inside, to be able to absorb the world as it is, as opposed to the world we want, and to do what we can to help turn the tide, but doing so will require greater and greater risk for some of us.
This is a great segue to my yes and question for you, because the whole idea around yes and is that people's default position is to say no or do nothing. That's easier.
Right.
We just say, actually, there's a technique for this. If you explore and heighten with the person across from you, sort of agree with what they're saying, build upon it. We have a phrase, you bring a brick, not a cathedral, to these conversations. Just bring the brick. Brick by brick. We build this thing together.
Right.
And we all have those moments in our lives. And sometimes they're related to books we write. Sometimes they're related to careers, sometimes to families. So I imagine you have thousands of yes and stories, which might be hard to sift through, but I'm just going to ask for one.
The most impactful yes and memories I have, both recent and longstanding, are of times when I have been on the receiving end of very harsh criticism from people who are not adversaries in any real sense, but people with whom I work very closely and in common cause. And so their critique and their anger at me is particularly painful. And I have one especially poignant memory of a time when I had to absorb a lot of energy coming toward me that felt, I won't say unjustified, but it felt like it was coming from a bigger place than whatever it was that I had done. But the yes and was to absorb it, to listen to it, to own whatever I could, and continue the conversation when it would have been easier for me either to, because I was in a position where I could have deflected it, I could have ignored it, I could have actually shut it down. And though all of those, every one of those options is tempting, and it's even more tempting the more authority a person has. But to say, no, actually, let's let it in. Let me hear them out. Let them be. I often say to my staff, it's okay if you get angry with me, but just let's continue the conversation. So I don't know if that fits exactly what.
It totally does.
But I've had entire days when all I've done is answer the emails, right? Or right. The phone calls and just say, I'm here. I'm listening. If you want to talk. And I've discovered that doing that, it doesn't neutralize the issue, but the memory of it in people's minds is qualitatively different than if I had left it untended to, right? And so it creates a different kind of narrative going forward.
I think back, you know, we're coming up to the end of 2025, and I'm just thinking about all these conversations and books I've read this year. Caroline Fleck talks about the need for validation, that yeah. If you simply start with this idea of validating the feelings of the person across from you, you don't have to agree with them. Right. But their feelings are their feelings. Mm-hmm. And validation is never wrong. And Alison Wood Brooks out of Harvard, whose wonderful book called Talk, it talks about the science around apologizing. And she goes, we can find no science that says that you shouldn't apologize ever. And for me, where I see that, we have this wonderful exercise that we do at Second City that I brought into we did with the FBI folks, but also with the we work with the crime lab at the University of Chicago. So it's a similar program, top tier top level police,
right.
And it's built off of yes and. So we were doing work at the University of Chicago with behavioral scientists. And they said, well, what happens when you can't yes and somebody? And we took months in terms of both in improv and then looking at the literature. And what we came up with, and there's studies on this now, is called Thank You Because. And what we do is we say, if you have a disagreement, thank the person for what they just said. So immediately you're setting off the gratitude part of the brain. And the because is very simple. You find something you value in the thing they just said. Right. That's it. And when we have people do this, and we've done it both where they do it together and we've had it where just one party does it, inevitably they find points of agreement. They are not mad with each other at the end of that. And it presents an opportunity. Now, here's a thing I've discovered in every session we've taught this in.
Okay.
That there is always one cop who will not do it.
Right. Right.
And I just want to go, dude. I just had you argue, because this is the arguments we have. You were arguing about Coke versus Pepsi, and you can't see the need to be right? It's harder as you escalate, but you can't do it when you're talking about dogs versus cats, which is what we give them. And so what we should know about that is hard stuff for people.
Right. Right. And you just said, like, I can think of a number of also relational dynamics where, you know, there's a certain percentage of the population who can't go there, and that's to be honored and respected for who they are. And not to hold the rest of humanity back, right? Like we're gonna move on this one. Yeah.
It's a wonderful book. It's called We Can Be Brave, How We Learn to Be Brave in Life's Decisive Moments. Marianne Edgar Buddy, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Really lovely to meet you, Kelly. Thank you.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.